Hello and a very warm welcome to the EMG Health Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Jonathan Sakia, and you're listening to the fourth episode of our five-part podcast series, sponsored by an educational grant from Sanofi Genzyme and Regeneron, in which the views and discussion might not represent the position or endorsement of either company. This series looks specifically at recent developments in moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. If you missed any of the previous episodes, then I encourage you to listen to these interesting topics, all with expert and fascinating guests, and I certainly learned a lot. In today's episode, we'll be exploring the role of dupilumab versus emerging Janus kinase or JAK inhibitor therapies in children, adolescents, and adults with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. Janus kinase is a family of intracellular non-receptor tyrosine kinases that transduce cytokine-mediated signals via the JAK-STAT pathway. The initial name was from just another kinase, J-A-K, get it? I love that. Actually, it's taken from Janus, the two-faced Roman god of beginnings, endings, and duality, because the JAKs possess two near identical phosphate transferring domains. To help me explore this topic and to educate me for sure are two highly respected experts. First, we have Dr. Chi-Ho Hong, who's a dermatologist based in Surrey, British Columbia, in Canada. He's a keen skier and mountain biker, loves to cook, and is a dab hand at smoking meats. Apparently, brisket is his specialty. The photograph alone had me salivating. Dr. Chi-Ho Hong, welcome. And I shall be popping over for dinner.
I would be pleased to have you, Jonathan.
Thanks for having me. I shall bring my appetite, Chi-Ho. We also have Dr. Peter Leo, who's a dermatologist in Chicago and is clinical assistant professor in the Department of Dermatology and Pediatrics at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine. When not treating patients, he's either doing his McCaid Arcade podcast on the 1980s, which I highly recommend. It's an absolute hoot. Or he's baking pizza and bread. Dr. Peter Leo, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
So we have two culinary experts and also two experts in atopic dermatitis. So let's dive into the latter. So Chi-Ho, let's start by talking about the mechanism of action of the drug dupilumab. What have been the key findings from the trials in children, adolescents, and adults with uncontrolled moderate to severe atopic dermatitis, AD? And when you're finished, then Peter, you leap in.
Well, the first part of that question is what's the mechanism of dupilumab? So dupilumab is a fully human monoclonal antibody that targets the IL-4 receptor alpha subunit of the IL-4 and IL-13 receptors. And these are two type 2 cytokines that mediate many of the features of atopic dermatitis and other type 2 immune diseases. Now, the second part was how does it work in children, adolescents, and adults? I'll start with the adult population. So the first dupilumab studies, of which there are a number of studies, including the SOLO-1, SOLO-2, the Kronos, and the CAFE studies, looked at the use of dupilumab in adult patients with moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. And all of these studies showed that this drug was very effective in terms of treating these patients. The primary outcomes for these studies were either looking at investigator global assessment of 0 or 1 at week 16 or the EASI-75 at week 16. In the adult study, which the results were mirrored by the adolescent and the children's study, was that this drug was highly effective and achieved both the IGA endpoint and the EASI-75 endpoints.
And Peter, you want to leap in and make comment?
For sure. I think that's a great overview. And I would just add that this is particularly interesting because for the first part of my career, we did not really have a systemic medication that was FDA approved in the United States for severe, moderate, or severe atopic dermatitis. So we were typically using a lot of off-label immunosuppressants. So dupilumab is all those things that we just heard, but it's also really the first biologic for atopic dermatitis. And because of that, it really has changed the way we can think about this disease, both in terms of more acute and intermediate treatment. But for me, the biggest change has been the longitudinal aspect of the drug, because we feel that it's more safely than some of the conventional immunosuppressants, we can keep and maintain patients on this medication. So it really has changed our practice, I think, throughout the world.
Well, thanks for that, Peter. And I think let's stay with you. I understand dupilumab was investigated in a 52-week trial. What's the safety and risk benefit profile given those long-term data? And are there any requirements for laboratory monitoring in patients on this drug?
Yes, and I think the fact that we have that 52-week data from the Kronos study is what gave us, especially at the very beginning, you know, anytime there's a new agent out there, there are many questions about the safety, particularly the long-term safety. So this gave us a lot of reassurances that at least for that 1 year period, we knew a lot more about it. I'm happy to say that when you look at the safety profile through week 52, it is actually very similar to what was seen in the first 16 weeks, which were kind of the original studies, SOLO 1 and SOLO 2, that we saw. They had 16-week endpoints. So that's very reassuring. And then to your point, it's actually kind of underscoring the safety in that there is no specific requirements for laboratory monitoring, so either at baseline or ongoing. And that's also a big deal because, for example, with off-label immunosuppressants, for example, cyclosporin, now that, of course, that's on-label in the EU, but in the US, that's off-label. We know we have to do quite a bit of laboratory monitoring, or for things like methotrexate, off-label everywhere, but frequently used, particularly historically. We know we have to be keeping an eye on a number of different labs. And of course, for some biologics, particularly the TNF inhibitors in psoriasis and many others, I think sort of by extension, there is some baseline labs that are usually required or at least recommended. And these include things like checking for tuberculosis, screening for hepatitis, and so on. But none of those apply to dupilumab, again, which I think is kind of exciting and really a break from the norm that tells us this is something a bit different.
So, I mean, I would imagine not having to do regular bloods is an advantage, especially when you're looking after kids, right? Hard enough that the poor things have to deal with the disease, but to have to have regular bloods must be a real pain, right?
It really is. And it's one of those funny things too, where people will say, well, it's a shot. So, you know, some people aren't going to be excited about getting the needle. But it is true that the trade-off then is you don't have to give blood. And I think that drawing blood is much more uncomfortable than doing a tiny little needle to administer a medication. So if I had to pick personally as a patient, I would much rather take a shot every 2 to 4 weeks as its dose, depending on the weight, but rather than having to get blood work every month or even every few months.
And Chiho, do you have anything to add to what Peter said?
I agree with what Peter said, but I think that one of the things that should be pointed out is that it provides patients a sense of comfort to know that they don't need to have blood work, or the parents of patients, they're much happier to hear that blood work is not required. I think that they associate that with an inherent quality of safety with the medication.
So Chiho, notwithstanding what Peter just said about on-label, off-label, which of course differs in different territories, dupilumab is of course not the first developed prescription drug for atopic dermatitis. In the past, we've used the likes of methotrexate, cyclosporin was mentioned, mycophenolate. It's pathetic. I'm a surgeon. This is too many syllables. Did dupilumab replace other treatment regimens? And if so, look, laugh at me. Everyone else does. And if so, why? Why did it replace these other regimes?
Well, I think as we sort of heard from Peter, that these medications were used off-label in most jurisdictions. Cyclosporin is approved for short-term use for treatment of atopic dermatitis in Europe only. But I think in much of the world that a number of immunosuppressing drugs like methotrexate, mycophenolate mofetil, azathioprine are used off-label to treat atopic dermatitis. And certainly one of the complications is that a number of laboratory monitoring investigations need to be done at baseline and on an ongoing basis for monitoring purposes. And one of the other issues is the long-term safety of these medications. So many of the patients that we treat are young, they're children or adolescents or young adults when they come to the clinic to get treatment for their moderate to severe atopic dermatitis. And for some of these patients, it's a lifelong problem. And we don't really want to have patients on cyclosporin long-term to treat their atopic dermatitis because we know that these drugs have end-organ toxicities. The development of a new drug like dupilumab, which is targeted and doesn't require laboratory monitoring and doesn't have end-organ toxicity, was a huge advantage for dermatologists and for our patients.
Peter?
I completely agree. And I think that's what's so exciting right now, too, because we finally have a new approach and we actually have a pipeline of new medications that are being developed. What it's going to force us to do, I think, as a specialty, and frankly, even outside of dermatology or allergy, because we're the ones who are most commonly treating these more severe cases. But I think everyone has to be aware of the new paradigm. And we're going to have to go back to the drawing board, in a manner of speaking, to talk about what is going to be the therapeutic algorithmic approach to treating these patients. And what I've found personally is that because of the safety and because of the efficacy that now over the past several years I've actually gotten to experience firsthand, I have lowered that threshold down from where it used to be sort of a last resort to use a systemic agent. Now I find myself saying earlier and earlier, you know, this could be the right way to go, in part because not only have we increasingly appreciated the massive impact on quality of life for our atopic dermatitis patients, again, particularly those who are more moderate and severe, exactly the group we're talking about, but we also are starting to think that by helping the disease and by being a little bit more stringent in terms of getting that therapeutic target, that treat-to-target goal, it is possible that we may be able to modify the progression of the disease itself in terms of the atopic dermatitis severity over time. And even the notion has been raised that we may be able to prevent the development of other allergies if we get that skin barrier healed from an early age. And that's still speculative, but I think there is a narrative that's being built here that's gaining more and more momentum. And I think people are starting to say this could be really important instead of being reactive and just letting people flare up and flare up and flare up and getting worse, often in this vicious cycle sort of situation. If we are much more proactive and gain control earlier, it may be beneficial even in ways we haven't accounted for yet.
Well, that makes perfect sense. Peter, let's stay with you and consider the emerging therapies. For example, there are at least three Janus kinase or JAK inhibitors being investigated for atopic dermatitis. How do they work and how do they differ from the biologics that we've been talking about?
Yes. So the JAK inhibitors are extremely exciting. Now, they exist in certain iterations already. So we know that two of them that are being studied extensively for atopic dermatitis are already approved in the United States for treatment of rheumatoid arthritis. So that includes baricitinib and upadacitinib. There's a third one called abrocitinib that is not out in any capacity yet. And then just this past year, baricitinib has received approval for treatment of atopic dermatitis in Europe and Japan. So these are kind of on their way out and very, very exciting. The biggest thing I think we understand about the JAK inhibitors is because they are small molecules, they can be orally taken. So the mode of administration allows us not to have to use an injectable subcutaneously, but they can be a pill, which makes things a little bit simpler. They work extremely quickly. From everything we understand, we're now thinking about their effect in terms of hours to days rather than, you know, weeks or even months with things like methotrexate or azathioprine off-label. These are happening very, very quickly. And the magnitude of the effect appears to be really, really impressive. The trade-off so far, and again, none of them are really approved for atopic derm in the United States, so we don't fully know, but we do know a bit about their safety profile. The trade-off here is that unlike the biologic agent we were talking about with dupilumab, these do have some laboratory monitoring that is required, both baseline and ongoing. And some of that is still being figured out. I personally don't exactly know what the specific recommendations in an atopic dermatitis population will be, but that, as we said before, can be a little bit of a deal breaker for some families. We also presume, again, we don't know for sure yet at the time of our recording today, but we presume there will be black box warnings on these products in the United States, which can have a chilling effect for patients and families. But we know this is a class-wide concept for these medications. So this is the sort of balance, maybe more powerful, maybe more rapid than dupilumab, but maybe with some caveats. So we have to, as clinicians, we have to kind of navigate this very, very tight rope.
Yes, it's true in all aspects of medicine, isn't it, that everything is having to make a risk-benefit determination and also to personalize treatment for given patients. Chiho, do you have anything to add to that?
I think that was a great summary of the upcoming oral molecules that are in development. And as you heard, one of them's been approved in some jurisdictions already. I'm excited because as a clinician, I think having a number of options to give to patients is helpful. There are situations potentially when an oral therapy may be preferred, but I think Peter very succinctly summarized the issue is that it's a trade-off between some efficacy factors with some issues related to safety. And the other issue is that currently for North America, we are not fully aware of what the labeling and potential warnings for these drugs once they hit the dermatology space are going to be.
Well, I'll tell you what, I want to come back to Peter's comment about black box warnings. But before I come back to Peter on that, can you I'll tell you what, let's do that. Peter, tell us about the, they're on the market for other diseases and they have black box warnings. What are the safety concerns, the key safety concerns when it comes to the use of JAK inhibitors? And then I'm going to come back to you, Chiho, to talk about the clinical trials that have been conducted with these drugs.
It's such an important point because we do know that while they already are approved for certain indications, as we said, for example, arthritis, and they're already used, the black box warning, at least on the ones that are out right now, do talk about the risk of serious infection and the risk of potential malignancy and the risk of thrombosis. So this is some of the things that are being discussed right now. And I think this can, again, have a little bit of a chilling effect on both patients and clinicians. One of the things we know is that a very small percent of dermatologists in North America actually write prescriptions at all for the immunosuppressives. I've heard some estimates, it may be difficult to know exactly, but I've heard estimates that it's only around 10%, and it's for sure less than one quarter. So those are medicines that have been around for decades. And the concern here is that we, even if these are very helpful, we may have trouble convincing clinicians who are already maybe a little bit apprehensive about using medicines with a lot of side effects to adopt these. And the fear here is that there will be patients who actually could be served very well by these, and the risk benefit analysis would actually suit them, but they won't have it available to them.
All right, so Chiho, talk us through the current phase 3 clinical trials conducted to date with JAK inhibitors for atopic dermatitis, given the background of all the things we've discussed.
Right, so as we've heard, there are 3 molecules that are in more advanced phase 3 clinical trials for the treatment of atopic dermatitis. There's baricitinib, and they had a number of research projects that were all entitled BREEZE-AD, and then they were numbered. Abrocitinib is another agent. They had primarily the JADE mono 1 and 2 studies, which are monotherapy studies, but they also looked at a combination with topical steroids, and then upadacitinib, which also did a monotherapy study and a topical corticosteroid add-on study. In addition, both abrocitinib and upadacitinib have done studies that are haven't been fully reported out, looking at head-to-head comparisons with dupilumab. That study has not been undertaken by baricitinib so far.
Anything to jump in with, Peter?
Yes, I think that was a great overview.
exciting stuff for us really are, it really lies in those comparative trials. So we have the Heads Up study and the Jade Compare study that will give us a little bit of a sense, at least, of how these JAK inhibitors compare to dupilumab. And they're not out yet. We've seen the press release, so we have a sense of the data, but we probably ought to wait, you know, until it's been peer reviewed and formally published before we comment. But I will say it does really seem that the JAK inhibitors are at least as good as dupilumab in terms of the speed and efficacy overall, and probably even better at their higher dosage, because they actually studied, particularly for abrocitinib, at two different doses, and it seems like at the higher dose it was superior. So very exciting to be able to compare these. And again, as a clinician, I'm always cogitating here, how are we going to position these when we talk to a patient? Because knowing the efficacy, how quickly it comes on, and the magnitude of the efficacy is an important part of the discussion, as well as that safety and the tolerability, and of course the accessibility. That's going to be a big question we have to figure out, because none of these medications are going to be inexpensive, right? They're all going to be branded. They're going to take some time before insurance companies cover them regularly. And that's another part of our task as clinicians.
So like any, well, I've already said this about risk-benefit ratios. And, you know, as I've learned together with your colleagues educating me through this process, learning about atopic dermatitis, it never really struck me as a surgeon that there's the disease of atopic dermatitis, and then there's the dis-ease. There's all the social issues, the disturbed sleep, and all those things. So I guess that all factors into decision-making. And Chiho, I know we're flogging this a little bit like a dead horse, if you will, about safety, but safety is important. And we've talked about black box warnings, but at present, data for the long-term efficacy and safety of JAK inhibitor use in patients with atopic dermatitis remains limited. What are some of the more severe adverse events for these drugs, and how can a dermatologist, a practicing dermatologist, mitigate risks for these? And, you know, we've talked about the black box warnings, but what else is there we need to be thinking about?
Yeah, I think currently when you look at the data that's been presented for the JAK inhibitors in the atopic dermatitis population, The main side effects that are worrisome are the increased risk of infection and also a signal for an increase in herpes virus infections, particularly for zoster. Now, none of these things in and of themselves are not, that as dermatologists, we're unable to manage, but there's certainly a signal from these agents that these things are increased over placebo treatment or compared to other therapies. And we don't necessarily see those signals from dupilumab or even some of the other biologic agents that are being investigated. So I think that's probably the main concern. If you look at the arthritis population where these drugs are more studied, it's a little bit harder to compare because it's a different patient population. The patients are older. They tend to be co-treated with multiple other drugs. They've had exposure to other drugs. And often when they take their JAK inhibitor, they're taking it with another traditional immunomodulatory or immunosuppressive drug. So it's a little bit harder to draw comparisons from our patient population, which tend to be younger, and they don't have often exposure to systemic medications like immunosuppressants or immunomodulators, at least for long periods of time. And so it's a little bit hard to know what to read from the RA or the other arthritis population that use this drug.
Okay, so Peter, I'd like to throw you another question. JAK inhibitors have a narrow therapeutic window and relatively short half-lives. What are the implications of this for patients with atopic dermatitis? And then Chiho, jump in with your thoughts, please.
I think the most important thing we're learning about them is that they might be better suited to using them strategically, because they work so quickly, they're very effective, but they're also out of your body very quickly. There's this idea that it is possible or maybe possible to treat patients a little bit more in that just-in-time way. So to be a little bit more reactive for breakthrough, and maybe this will make them a little bit less suitable for longitudinal treatment. And one of the things we've been talking about in some of our little groups where we chat about the upcoming treatments is that maybe we'll be able to start people who are really uncomfortable, sort of in extremis. We can put them on a JAK inhibitor because we know it will work very deeply and very quickly. And then we can concomitantly start them on a biologic agent. And while the biologic agent is ramping up over those couple of months, we could then potentially taper off the JAK inhibitor so that they really can have continuous control and improvement, but switching off some of the risks and benefits over time. And I think that's an exciting possibility, aside from the fact that I love the concept that precision medicine is really important. When we talk about precision or personalized medicine, we think about what's the best drug for this patient in terms of efficacy? But really, it's also important, the other side of that coin, what's the safety and tolerability for this patient as well? And I think it's a great point that the rheumatoid arthritis population is pretty different than atopic dermatitis population. So I'm hoping we can have the foresight and the clarity of vision to be able to say, yes, as a class, there are risks that are associated, but within this group of patients, and ideally within this particular patient, we hope we can give a much better assessment of those risk-benefit trade-offs of each medication.
You know, it's been lovely as we've been going through these questions to hear two colleagues agreeing and enforcing what each has said. And I don't want to force fit this, but Chiho, do you have anything to add?
I don't necessarily disagree. I think that what Peter says is on point there. We're going to have a number of different treatments. They're going to have pros and cons. We're going to have to maybe learn a bit more about all the treatments and maybe combination of treatments, because one type of treatment may provide very rapid disease control, and you can transition that patient to a therapy that'll provide longitudinal disease control. That obviously has not been studied, but it's potentially something that I'm sure many people that treat a lot of these patients have thought about, seeing the data from the different studies.
Yeah, so this next question, I don't want to get political, but we've got a doctor working in Canada and a doctor working in the United States. And as we live through this time of COVID, the role of vaccinations becomes critically important, not just for the people who are vaccinated, but for the population as a whole. And we think about people who are living with chronic disease and do have potentially compromised immune systems. So I'd like you to view the, when you both answer this, I'd like you to think about some of the, I guess, geopolitical elements of this, about what you're seeing in your world. So I understand that before starting JAK inhibitors, patients should be up to date with their vaccinations and that live vaccines should be avoided while on the drug. Now, of course, for COVID, they're not live vaccines. They're RNA vaccines that stimulate our immune system to make the spike protein that our immune system then reacts to. So presumably, can patients receive COVID vaccination if they're receiving a JAK inhibitor? And what are you seeing in your practice with regards to any vaccine hesitancy? Peter, why don't you go first?
I am lucky that in my practice in Chicago, we have not seen a lot of hesitancy. Most of my patients are quite excited and enthusiastic about getting vaccinated because I think it really holds the promise of getting back to normal, or at least some version of normal in the near future. So everyone seems pretty excited. Some of my patients, though, of course, I focus on atopic dermatitis. So I have many patients who are very severe, have many allergies, and there can be some concern that they could react to the vaccine in an allergic way, because we know that is certainly a possibility. And I'm happy to say so far, I've had many dozens of them get vaccinated. The worst I've seen is maybe a small eczema exacerbation after vaccination, and nothing, thank goodness, that was dangerous for these patients. So I'm feeling more and more comfortable about it. Now, that brings up the next point. What about if they're already on dupilumab? Is that an issue? And we really don't think so. Dupilumab, should not interfere, as far as we understand, with inactivated non-live vaccines like the COVID vaccines that are out right now. So that seems reassuring. And we think that the immune response while on dupilumab should be comparable to those who are not. So that's good. And that's been shown. They actually did a study looking at Tdap and meningococcal polysaccharide vaccines. So the response was very good. Now, the truth may be a little different for the JAK inhibitors, which are a little bit more broadly immunosuppressive. So I don't know if there is a risk that the vaccination response will not be as robust, but I do know that Dr. Fauci himself a few months back was quoted as saying patients who are on immunosuppressive therapies are probably still in a better place to get the vaccine, because even if they don't get the most robust response, any response may be actually worthwhile. And maybe all it would take is a booster at some point if they didn't mount the full response. In other words, it's not a tolerability or a safety concern on more broad immunosuppression. It's simply that they may not get as robust of a reaction as we'd like them to get. And to me, I think that still does not negate it.
And Chiho, what are you seeing in British Columbia?
We are currently recommending all patients on targeted therapeutics, whether they're biologic agents or they're oral small molecules. So that includes dupilumab, other type 2 biologics that are in clinical trial, and all of our patients who are on JAK inhibitors, and they're all on JAK inhibitors in studies because the drugs haven't been approved yet. So they're all study patients. We are recommending and providing documentation that these patients can indeed receive any of the currently approved COVID vaccines in Canada. So they could get the mRNA vaccines or the other vaccine candidates that are currently approved in Canada. So we are recommending. I think Peter touched on the two issues. One is it safe? And currently with the types of vaccines that we have, because none of them are live, we feel that they are safe. And there is a theoretical concern about a less robust immune response on some agents. But again, I agree that on the whole, it is safer for the patient to receive a vaccine and have a less robust immune response than to not receive a vaccine at all and remain highly susceptible to this new coronavirus.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd like you both to address this. Regarding the best long-term treatment strategy for patients with AD, and you've already both hinted at combination therapies and such like, but are JAK inhibitors more likely to be a second-line treatment option alongside dupilumab? Well, what do you both think, Peter? Why don't you go first?
My thinking right now, and of course, I really want to make sure I have a long lead to be able to change my opinions as the medicines come out and we get more familiar with them. But my thinking here is that they probably will be better suited for more targeted, shorter-term therapy for most patients. That being said, I do have a list right now, a waiting list of patients that have, for one reason or another, essentially failed everything that we have thus far and are eagerly anticipating the new JAK inhibitors. And I'm extremely hopeful that these are going to be a solution for these patients who are absolutely miserable and have a ton of suffering. So for at least a group of patients, this may be something we'll do medium or even long-term, because those benefits will be so much better than the potential risks. But for other patients, they may fill a different niche. Now, the last thing I want to say is that we're also in the midst of changing treat to target. I think historically, we've been actually fairly comfortable just saying, yeah, we're going to try to get your eczema a bit better, and hopefully we will. And sometimes you just kind of have to tough it out because we just didn't have that much. But increasingly, I think we're saying if we can get excellent disease control and maintain it safely over a long period of time, I think this is the new standard of care, or it's becoming the standard of care. So because there are an endless number of new patients who are individuals, we ultimately have an endless amount of need for new therapies and new therapeutic approaches. So it's going to take all of our creativity, all of the new innovations, and really creating a shared decision-making framework with our patients to build that therapeutic alliance to get each and every patient to their therapeutic goal.
Chiho?
Yeah, so I think one of the challenges will be when we have longer term data for the JAK inhibitors. I think one of the concerns that prescribers may have, at least initially, will be that these drugs may be approved with 100 weeks of continuous follow-up or maybe a little bit longer. I think that the longer the patients are continuously exposed to medication, and not having any side effects that come up, I think that'll provide reassurance. There are, as Peter mentioned, many types of patients that have different types of eczema, and they have flare-ups and different degrees of severity. So you may have some people that have more intermittent flare-ups that may be more appropriately treated with medications that can be start and stop at different times. And then some people that have very severe disease that doesn't really flare, it's just severe all the time, they may be more appropriately treated with something that provides a higher degree of longitudinal control. I think some of these issues remain to be worked out. I agree with Peter that many of us that treat these patients are trying to adapt concepts that we learned from psoriasis towards treating atopic dermatitis, and thinking about a treat to target model for atopic dermatitis, that will undoubtedly lead to better disease outcomes in the long run, and hopefully patients will feel more engaged in the decision-making process, which ultimately is better for the patient.
Well, you've given such a robust and 360 degree view on this topic. It's been marvelous. In closing, I always like to ask my guests something aspirational. If you woke up tomorrow and you discovered that you very agreeable gentlemen were joint chief medical officers of the world, what one thing would each of you do to make the world a better place? Maybe provide pizza and smoked brisket for everyone would be a good start. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. I think from my standpoint, again, knowing that, you know, there are limitations on our power in the world of medical care, I think I really would try to get at least a basic amount of medical care available for everybody on the planet. I do think that we can all help each other by getting some basic medical care available for all. And even though, of course, I realize it's a very politically charged concept, I do love the concept that in a very civilized world, healthcare could be one of the expected rights for everybody.
And for me, since we are recording this in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic, my wish would be that there is enough vaccine so that everybody on this planet could get vaccinated in the next 4 weeks and that we could get kind of back to normal.
Yeah, it's a great point, isn't it? Because everyone's health is everyone's business. So listen, chaps, thank you so much. Atopic dermatitis is a common and chronic global concern. And for those with uncontrolled symptoms, AD can significantly reduce sleep and overall quality of life of affected individuals, as well as impact their families, as I said earlier, and as I've been learning through this series. And due to its long-term and chronic nature, it's vital to select treatment options that are both safe and effective and work to relieve disease burden of this disease. It's important that dermatologists are aware of any potential adverse events or risks associated with the use of any treatment option in order to promote a higher standard of treatment and quality of living. And I think what I've seen from the two of you, what I've heard from the two of you, is this unity of thought and this collaborative approach to education. So Drs. Chi-Ho Hong and Peter Leo, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the podcast today to share your experience. And importantly, Peter and Chi-Ho, I want to thank you both for all the work you do for patients.
Well, thank you. It was an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much for inviting me and for having me. It was really fun.
Well, it was my pleasure. And I did mention Peter's podcast. It's the McQuaid, which is McQuaid Arcade. The McQuaid Arcade. I've been listening to it. And I'm hoping that we can get these two wonderful doctors to also provide us with some recipes. So look, folks, that's it for today's episode. Please remember to look out for the final episode in this series on the subject of atopic dermatitis. Please take care, and we hope to have you join us for all episodes of the EMG Health Podcast. Bye for now.